Okay.
Keep going.
Yeah. 3, 2, 1. And we are back with episode 815 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Washington Heights. And let me tell you a story. Whether you believe it is up to you.
And Edmund just completely takes my train of thought away from me. I'm just so glad he's back. At least for a little while. I got nothing.
A few people had nothing at the end of some of these episodes, so there you go. Yes, we are going to be getting into the episodes that, are from about a couple of weeks ago, so by now hopefully you have seen them, but just in case you haven't, I suppose we should give some kind of warning, maybe like a spoiler warning or something. What do you think, Edmund?
I think I might be able to handle that. Our policy here is, especially on some of these shows, is we are going to tell you about anything and everything that happened in them, all the way up to and including the end. So yes, you will be spoiled if you haven't seen them.
There you go. And, well, we are going to go ahead and, as always, we're going to start with our bottom three, then go to our top three, and then if there's any of the ones in the middle that we want to discuss, we will. This particular week, there were 10 shows that aired that are on our list, a total of 11 episodes, because, as is often the case anymore when a show premieres, they just have to show 2 episodes. Why do they do that? Anyway... but yes, one of those, of course, we did not have anybody give any scores for. I just left Class on the list for my own purposes, just in case somebody else may have caught up with it. But no, it's still off of my list at this point. So that one we do not have any scores or commentary for. But that leaves 9 other shows, 10 other episodes to delve into. So that being the case, we're going to get into the bottom 3. All shows this week were above average, but these were the ones that were closer to the average mark. Coming in at an average of 7.5, we have Fear the Walking Dead, Season 3, Episodes 1 and 2, Eye of the Beholder, and The New Frontier. The Clark family find themselves in a dire predicament and must work together to discover a path to safety. Boy, that is the most generic description of a Fear the Walking Dead episode that you could ever have. Isn't that essentially every episode?
Yes, I was going to say, not just Fear the Walking Dead and any Walking Dead story.
Right.
Is there something next to the description that says, type real storyline here?
Yeah. Right. Well, maybe it's in this next one. Following a harrowing journey, the Clark family arrive at their new home, and Strand faces resistance as he attempts to hold power over his domain. Nope, that's not any less generic, is it? That pretty much describes these 2 episodes, unfortunately. Fairly generic. I say in my notes here... that, and this is a spoiler for those who didn't want to know, but if you really were going to watch the show, you've already probably done it. They killed off a main character. And I didn't care. It was just happening. It really just, there's no connection to the characters at this point. And yeah, it's really just about the shock value. And there was some fun shock value, as in somebody getting a spoon in the eye socket. That was pretty nasty, and it worked out pretty well in terms of how it played out. But and that was a little more interesting because you don't see that every day. But yeah, the villains in the of the piece were kind of familiar, overly familiar. They went for spectacle, and it didn't really work. And other than Strand, there's really nobody who's interesting anymore, which is unfortunate. So. It's definitely a show that is down towards the bottom of my list at this point, sadly. Especially with other things that are on Sunday nights that are a heck of a lot more interesting.
Also, do you feel that the premise of the show has already worn itself out?
I think we've already said before that the premise of Fear the Walking Dead never really seemed to get realized. It was supposed to be a show that was more about the beginning of the timeline, and they've already jumped well past that. And even though it's in a different setting, they just keep repeating things that we've essentially already seen. So I don't know that it's really staking its own identity very well, as far as I can tell. At least not here at the beginning. We'll see. Maybe it might pick up later, but this first 2 episode stretch here was very generic. Also coming in at a 7.5 is iZombie, Season 3, Episode 10, Return of the Dead Guy. Let's see, the description here is Peyton and Liv go on a surprising wild goose chase. Ravi is terrified when the zombie truth hunters' plans are revealed. Major finds comfort in an unexpected and perhaps unwelcome friend. And like I said, 7.5. There were way too many plot threads going on that were being juggled, so it was a bit hard to follow everything. And yeah, that means that the scene where Liv was a sub for Peyton, who was posing as a dominatrix, that was the main highlight. Not going to lie. There's a reason that they were showing that in the promos. Yeah. Sadly, it was only about 2 minutes of the episode, so the rest of the episode was just a bunch of plot threads that was kind of hard to follow. I like that this season of iZombie is a lot more plot-driven, and the episodic brain of the week type things seem a lot more inventive than they were in the second season, but yeah, it is kind of bogging down now towards the end as they're trying to bring all those threads together. All right, and that brings us to the show that's at the bottom of the list, and it's a little bit surprising, although perhaps not when we get into some of the discussion, and that would be Twin Peaks, Season 3, Episode 5, The Return, Part 5. Case Files. That's the official description. I didn't make that one up.
Yeah,
so before we get into that, Edmund, have you been watching any of the new Twin Peaks?
I got to about midway through Episode 3, and I've been taking a break since then.
Okay, I can completely understand that, considering how season or episode 3 starts.
Well, I think it was right around the car crash. Actually, it was.
Ah, okay, yes.
Yeah, so I got that far. I did get past the whole odd sucked into the radio opening, but
yes. Okay. Yeah. You haven't gotten to the point that is, at least from my point of view, some of the funnier stuff that they've done in a long time.
It really was just a case of, some of the stuff we've been talking about this week already. I mean, there was just other things that were grabbing me more, like Sense8 and 12 Monkeys getting splashed out all at once, and ongoing Handmaid's Tale, which we haven't touched on yet. But so it's one that's sitting there, and I do intend to go back to, but it's not compelling my eyeballs. Let's put it that way.
Now, what's interesting for me, and I mean, Gary, I will let you kind of weigh in on your average rating here in a moment. I really feel like I understand why they front-loaded the first four episodes. Because with episode 5, things have slowed down dramatically. And while there are still things that I find amusing and fun and nostalgic about it, I also feel like, wow, the story is dragging a bit now. How about you, Gary? I mean, where do you stand? Because a 7's a pretty much dead average for us, so it just seems like, yeah, they might have lost their momentum here.
Well, I've decided to look at the show a different way.
Okay.
I was considering this a show that had a storyline, and I've given up any pretense of that. This is an art house film. This is purely visual eye candy, and any attempt at a storyline, at least thus far, has been negligible. And really, we have a whole bunch of these sort of little vignette scenes that really don't seem to string together in any real meaningful way. So, I'm almost looking at this as a whole series of not even short films, just shorts, where we get these sort of little pieces, and they don't really seem to fit together at all. So yes, they're visually interesting. I technically know a background storyline, so I can follow what they're trying to show in each one of these scenes, but to my knowledge, there's no real thread tying them all together in any way, at least not any consequential way for me. So the idea that it's a storyline anymore is gone for me. I'm sort of walking through the museum looking at the pictures at this point.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that feeling. I do think that there are some things that are slowly starting to connect in the background, but they're not moving very fast yet. I'm hoping that changes because we're rapidly getting to the midpoint, or at least to at this point we are pretty much at the what should be the end of the introductory part of any story. So knowing that Lynch does his own thing is kind of hard to know if he's going to do that or not, but it does feel like there are pieces still being laid out, but he's taking his sweet time, which is fine. As you said, it's interesting in its own way, but I think that I even mentioned that at the end of part 4 that I really hoped that they wouldn't stretch out the Dougie Jones thing very long, and boy did it feel like it was being stretched out here. Not just here. We will talk about that again soon. But in this particular episode, it just felt like things are moving incrementally at best. And yeah, I agreed. It kind of dropped a full point just for me because I was enjoying the heck out of the premiere, especially the material that you haven't quite gotten to yet, Edmund, mm-hmm. which, you know, when Dougie was originally introduced, and then they go through that sequence of, you know, him in the casino and everything after that, it's hilarious stuff. But it's a one, it's really something that you do once and then move on from, and they haven't moved on from it. So this is one of those situations where, while I completely, I know that Gary, we've kind of talked back and forth, is this the kind of show that you binge watch, or is it maybe best to take it in pieces because then you need your brain to actually engage and, you know, kind of work itself past what you just were watching. Here we've hit a bit of a lull, and I don't know that there's really a lot in this episode per se that was challenging, other than the fact that it felt like it took way too long for certain things to happen. If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, to me it does, but it's, you know, it's one thing not confuse isn't the right word, to be puzzled by what direction they're going in. But I don't even feel they're going in a direction, so that's a...
Well, I'm hoping that this is one of those situations where everything seems disconnected, and then when you get to the end, you'll kind of see where everything was playing out. But yeah, I get the point. This particular episode, there were a lot of little scenes that took things like... Literally, I believe this was the episode where there was just a scene of Andy and Hawk staring at papers for like 2 minutes, and that was the advancement of that storyline. Nothing else happened, and it's like, okay, that seems awfully unnecessary. So, yeah, unfortunately, this was a low point so far. Let's see.
I'd actually say, as I look at this, I'm watching this, I was like, geez, could I have Haven back? It wasn't much better Twin Peaks. At least what I was expecting.
Right.
But this isn't, you know, this isn't your father's Twin Peaks. This is, to me, even though we're getting characterization similar and a similar setup, it really is its own unique show. To say it's a continuation is inaccurate.
Like I said, until we see where it all plays out, because this is all meant to be one piece kind of broken into 18 parts. So it's hard to say.
Oh, I'll keep watching, but like I said, I don't feel the story right now.
Okay. Edmund, why don't you take our number three show for the week on our top three?
Absolutely. That would be Better Call Saul, season 3, episode 8, Slip, where Jimmy is pushed to desperate measures, Nacho picks up a new skill, Mike explores an alliance, and Kim stands up to Hamlin. And I gave this an 8.5. It was a bit of a transitional episode after some of the fireworks of chicanery and Chuck finally getting his comeuppance. This was more exploring sort of what happens after that, because even though yes, it was a victory in terms of Jimmy not being disbarred, he is still suspended, so he's still trying to figure out what he's going to do for a year, showing him, as the title says, starting to slip down that path towards becoming Saul Goodman. The official slip of the title is him tripping on a drumstick, a musical drumstick, to basically con some guys he's trying to sell commercial time to. So a little bit of Slippin' Jimmy con man persona that they showed us at the very beginning of the series, coming out of his past life, before he tried to go straight and become a good respectable lawyer like his brother. And on the other parts of the plot line, kind of similar threads of people taking additional steps along their various journeys. We've had with Nacho, as he's trying desperately to keep Hector Salamanca from going after his Nacho's father's business as a front. I was rather amused at the recap. It's rather amazing that for an AMC show they were actually giving some major plot points in the recap. It involves Nacho working on how to doctor Hector's heart medication, so learning a little bit of pharmaceutical skills and a little bit of sleight of hand, the Mike and Gus Fring and Nacho and Hector side of things tends to show us more clever ways that people can try and con each other and get one up on each other. Better Call Saul is continuing to be this interesting blend of Jimmy's story, as well as certainly with Gus and Mike starting to sort of warily circle around each other, with Mike asking Gus to launder some of his ill-gotten gains for him. Yes, it is showing us that path towards Breaking Bad, but still with just a very interesting character beats as we go along. It's kind of like the whole drug king angle of it is something that's still very, very much in the background, and it's more focusing on Bob Odenkirk and Rhea Seehorn and Jonathan Banks and Howard and Chuck as well, taking advantage of these wonderful actors and letting them play out some very interesting life changes.
All right. Sounds good. Definitely sounds worthy of our number three show for the week. All right. And that brings us to our number two show for the week. And this was a unanimous 9. And that would be American Gods, Season 1, Episode 6, A Murder of Gods. The new gods show of force send Shadow and Mr. Wednesday on the run and in search of a safe haven in the company of one of Mr. Wednesday's oldest friends, Vulcan, god of the fire and the forge. And as I said, this came in at a unanimous 9. And Gary, this is, I think, the first time that you've actually had a chance to score this show, so you've caught up at least this far.
Yes, yeah, and oh boy, am I glad I did. I'm enjoying this show. I'm enjoying the actors, and they're doing it in such a way. I read this book many years ago, but as I'm doing it, it's really coming back to me, which is sort of surprising that a part of your brain turns on and really starts to enjoy it all over again. But at the same time, sort of, hey, wait a minute. Anyway, I really love the show. It's doing really well for me. I just feel it's cast well. The vision is even better than I sort of pictured it in my head. When you picture reading these books and you want to, you picture them on screen, and I just figured it a little bit more, neat, and it's a little bit more messy, and it makes sense that it's more messy, and I'm finding I'm really enjoying it in a different way than I did the book. So, the series is going really well for me. I'm not too far ahead of this, but I'm looking forward to finishing it up. And did they renew it yet?
Yes, they did.
Yes.
Oh, good, good. Okay, well, then I have even stuff to look forward to. I continue to enjoy Wednesday a great deal as a character. He doesn't quite seem he doesn't. At times, he almost seems omniscient, but he just seems, well prepared, which might be is something somewhat different. So, I like it a lot. He feels very down to earth for who he is and who he's supposed to be. So, I don't want to gush too much, but it was, I'm enjoying him. I'm enjoying Shadow a great deal as well. The actor is doing a good job for this role. I have no problem suspending disbelief to just sink into the show. Is there anything that's not working for you guys in the show? Because it's going really well for me.
Edmund, you haven't really had a chance to weigh in directly, despite your comments that you've given. So,
I of course did happen to read the book more recently. I think it was in the last year or so. So, it's still relatively fresh in my mind. Although I've been realizing, comments here and others I've been reading out on the interwebs, I'm realizing that one interesting thing might be to actually go back and start rereading now that I've actually seen this, because I know I mean there are so many different tales and stories and weave throughout that book that I kind of feel sometimes there were bits that I didn't take in as well, but that said, I mean, I have been extremely pleased with the way that this adaptation is playing out, and actually, I mean, with this particular episode, I mean, certainly with liberties they took, but the changes they decided to make to the Vulcan storyline, and certainly this whole thing of making him the god of firearms, bringing in some of that more topical and on point commentary about the current state of American society and gun culture. This was a case of where it didn't feel like a show just being topical for the sake of it. Certainly some of your comments about Sense8, John, and I would even say if we get to it, I mean, in terms of this week's shows, I mean, some of the stuff that was going on in Doctor Who, which was feeling like, you know, very much trying to make new sort of 1984 type commentary and feeling a little too forced and on the nose, in this case, just seemed to naturally integrate into the story, as well as being played for some very good conflict and twists and betrayal, and certainly a rather extraordinary conclusion with Mr. Wednesday, showing off some of his chutzpah and power in the end after being portrayed as someone very compelling, but one of these gods who is a bit seedy and on the downside of his popularity, but tossing Vulcan into the forge is a nice way of reasserting your authority.
Yeah, one could definitely say that. This one in particular, I mean, if I were just to say, as far as the adaptation goes, what's really interesting to me is not just updating Vulcan, but the fact that I recall the book was very much from Shadow's point of view, with interstitial stories, of course, about the various gods. But the main narrative was largely seen from his perspective, where the show, as far as the adaptation goes, takes a different tactic. I mean, just what they're doing with Laura in particular is really quite interesting, because they're giving her a voice that the book never really did. It's not necessarily one that I like any better than I did in the book, but it's interesting to give the character a little bit more agency and depth. I still find it, one of the interesting things about Laura Moon is the fact that she is so unlikable, and intentionally so. And it's very unusual to have a character that is written so unabashedly, just almost unredeemable in some respects, and yet it's a compelling character that you are fascinated to watch as it continues to unfold in its various ways and means. But in this particular episode, yeah, I really like the road trip aspect of it with Laura and the leprechaun. And of course the stuff with Vulcan, like you said, was just, despite the fact that it was ridiculously on point, it was done very well. Any other thoughts on American Gods from you guys? Since again, Gary, you're catching up, and Edmund, this is kind of your first go at the show.
Thanks for reminding me of my Laura and the Leprechaun crack, because certainly, I mean, I was feeling better about that storyline this time around, and I think certainly, I mean, sort of, I mean, making it the triple act as well, I mean, having Salim there is sort of this, you know, because certainly the her and Sweeney are
hold on, my you're recording still, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Keep going.
Okay.
Because mine kind of crashed, so.
No, okay, okay. Since the two of them can be a little, you know, can be quite abrasive and not that likable, and having this example of an acolyte, and, you know, this recent convert and all of his fervor, in addition to, of course, I mean, actually, you know, showing, you know, somebody who's actually still keeping to his usual religious practices is making for an interesting addition to the story, because until you'd mentioned it, John, yeah, I was forgetting that, you know, yeah, in the book, I mean, it really is Shadow's story. I mean, it's not it's not quite, you know, for first person singular, but yeah, everything is pretty much from his perspective. That classic thing of when you're adapting something, you know, trying to open it out broaden the horizons, and I think that they have been managing to do that pretty well.
Yes, I would definitely agree. And as far as broadening out from an adaptation, that brings us to our number one show for the week.
Yes.
And that would be The Leftovers, Season 3, Episode 8, The Book of Nora.
Oh, yes.
Answers are elusive in the series finale. But that's not entirely true, is it? Or is it? I don't know. this one coming in at a 9.75, so really high up on the scale. And for me, I thought that while there was a little bit of meandering in the episode that took a little bit off the top, it didn't seem to for you, Edmund, but for me it did. When they got to Nora's final monologue, that was some captivating stuff.
Yeah.
It manages what I think that Lindelof and Cuse were trying to do with Lost a lot better than they did it with Lost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the sense, and that's even knowing that I like the way that they did it in Lost, in the sense that the answer that you get at the end, you can take it entirely on the face of it in terms of what was said and what was explained, or you can see it as one person's rationalization of their own decisions. And I really like that idea that, at least for me, one interpretation I had was that I feel like she really did experience what she said. And that the title of the episode, The Book of Nora, was an indication that where the Book of Kevin would have been the kind of recitation of the mystical side of, or interpretation of the sudden departure and the days after, what Nora's book would do, true or not, it really doesn't matter, but the book that she eventually, you could posit, she eventually puts out there, metaphorically or not, is the closure that people need. Because I could very easily see her in the future from this point, 5 years in the future or whatever, writing a book that becomes the kind of seminal explanation or exploration of what happened, right? You see where I'm going with this?
Oh, absolutely.
But if you just kind of the whole idea, and from what I understand, this is kind of in the original book, and I can see that this definitely was something that they played with, but the whole idea that there is a parallel universe where, from their perspective, 98% of the population disappeared.
Yes.
That just made my jaw drop, because I never in a million years considered that possibility. And yet it made sense when they finally explained that or said that. And it was like, oh, no, that could potentially make a lot of sense. It's just some kind of weird thing where it's split into two separate universes. And, you know, the whole idea that where in this universe people are dealing with how can I get away with or live with the fact that one person was departed, they had to deal with everyone else being gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, boom, you know, it's like that, just the idea that that's there, and whether or not it's true is almost immaterial, because it does give closure to this idea that these characters just needed to find themselves and find where they fit after just cataclysmic event of loss and grief. And the fact that Nora and Kevin kind of come to where they get to at the end was really poignant. But I've said a lot about this episode, so why don't you go ahead and weigh in on on your interpretation as well.
And just to clarify, yes, that 9.75 is because I did go for the 10, with the usual explanation that for us, a 10 doesn't necessarily mean perfection, but it's just when an episode, or in this case a series finale, just hits that absolute sweet spot, where it just feels absolutely right. And in this case, part of that being feeling absolutely right is because it wasn't completely explaining everything, I really liked what you said just now, John, about, her giving an explanation or exploration. I think that kind of brings up, lays out the two options really, really nicely. Certainly, I mean, from the beginning, I mean, we'd had the end of episode one where we first saw this older Nora, and getting asked about Kevin and denying his existence, seemingly, the fact that that was set up for them to circle back, and after some of the wilder shenanigans of the last few episodes, the Frasier orgy boat, and Kevin going back to his warped world again. In the last episode, the fact that they made the decision to bring it down to just this simple story of, okay, here's Nora, 20 years later, as it turns out. Even throughout the whole opening parts of the episode and the setup to it, of where you're not sure of, being a little coy about, okay, is she on this side or did she make it to the other side? Especially when Kevin shows up with this seemingly alternate history or alternate story. Starting to get you into that mindset of, what did actually happen when she stepped into the machine. Certainly, I mean, yes, I mean, you know, that final monologue, I mean, yeah, I mean, was this extraordinary, crowning moment. But some of the earlier stuff as well. I mean, her farewell with Matt, with some glorious work between Carrie Coon and Christopher Eccleston, and this whole thing of her relating the story of the other side being where the 98% went away, and tracking her family down and realizing that on this side they're the lucky ones because they have just about everybody except for me, and it's not appropriate for me to mess with that, but just that whole scenario and metaphor for, as a way of finally coming to terms with her own angst and grief and all the nihilistic behavior that's engendered in her over these three seasons, I thought was just marvelously done, and a wonderful way of wrapping, wrapping it up, but no, I mean, just bringing this story to a close and bringing these two people back together, that wonderfully simple Kevin at the end after this amazing monologue, and the key thing is him just saying, "I believe you." And, yes, I don't think he put that much emphasis on the eye. I was just doing that, but, because that was the crucial part. And I was realizing on reflection, I'm kind of intrigued that we've now in this season had two series finales, this one and Black Sails, that revolve around these people telling a story that may or may not be true, but that serve the purpose for their own psychological well-being and the well-being of those around them to tell it and at least have it mostly believed. It's a series that started out so bleak, in hindsight, a lot of people were talking about, season one was so depressing and so hard to get through for them to work through that and reach this point of something feeling So natural and so right. And, you know, not that, you know, these are still, you know, extremely damaged people who have, you know, gone through some extraordinarily harrowing things, but have managed to come out the other side. And it was just a wonderful thing to experience and go along with them.
Yeah, just as a final statement on The Leftovers, I mean, what is really interesting to me is that while the first season definitely was pretty dark, the thing that always got me was that I felt like the second season was a lot more emotionally and psychologically challenging. And I expected the third season, because it was the end of the story, it was going to ramp that to unbelievable heights. And yet, I felt like the third season was spare with those moments almost. It's almost like it was priming you for the idea that there was something on the other side of this whole process. And yeah, I really appreciate the fact that they took the story in some unexpected directions, because you can see how many people could have predicted that, oh, the final 8 episodes of The Leftovers is going to be just one big, huge depressive fest. And it really wasn't. There were some darker moments for sure, but there were also some moments that were surprisingly cathartic for the characters, and put them in a much better place than I think we could have expected. And then, of course, there was that whole episode with him in the international assassin world, which is just always bonkers and fun. So,
yeah, and actually, I just want to mention, I mean, in terms of another of those progressions through the three seasons, you know, certainly, I mean, in terms of Nora's story, I mean, it being jump-started this season with Marklyn Baker's rather extraordinary guest appearance, and the fact that they went from, this tongue in cheek joke about the Perfect Strangers cast all being disappeared, and then it turns, and then it's like, oh no, Marklyn Baker wasn't, but he's just been, he's been hiding out, pretending that he was one of the disappeared, to then bring, actually bringing him in, and taking what had been some comic relief, and turning it into, this rather extraordinary little twist, and having Marklyn Baker, really sell it both to Nora and to the audience, for those who may or may not know, actually bringing up some of the stuff that actually is in fact true. Yes, he does have 2 degrees from Yale. isn't just that goofy guy who hung around with Balky.
Yeah, it was an interesting way for them to go, that's for sure. So a really strong series finale for The Leftovers, and certainly glad to see that happen.
Yes, Mr. Linda Hoff did learn some lessons from last time.
Yes.
Or last time, I should say.
Gary must be loving this episode. Anyway, just to kind of round this out, because I think that we'll have one more show that we want to briefly talk about. But some of the other shows that ran this week, the original, Season 4, Episode 10, Phantomesque got an 8, as did Outcast Season 2, Episode 10, To the Sea, which was the second season finale and possibly the series finale. Unfortunately, it didn't really help that it ended on a major cliffhanger. Sound familiar?
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And much like that other series, this was a season that was, at least in my mind, a bit spare on plot. Yeah. So it could have done things a little bit differently. All right, but that brings us to the last show that was on this week, which was Doctor Who Series 10, Episode 8, The Lie of the Land, which came in at a 7.83. And just a few brief comments on this one, maybe, because we have referred to it so far. And Gary, you actually gave it a pretty high score.
Oh, gosh, this was the first episode all season I liked. Jeez. I'm not sure what it was that I liked. Bill had some action, which was nice. Nardole was really fun, but not goofy, I guess. And the Doctor's hidden agenda really had me going for a while. So I just thought it was I was really fun. I enjoy these whole world at risk type of episodes a lot. The characters came to life, and I'm very grateful for it. I even liked Capaldi in this episode, John. That's how good it was.
Ooh, wow. Okay.
And in case Edmund didn't know, I've had issues this season. So.
Yes, I've heard, yes.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's not something that you particularly keep to yourself. I don't think that we liked the episode as much.
No, I mean, for me, it feels like they're just going to the well a little too often of these aliens that come in and brainwash humanity, and you know, whether it's these guys or the Silence, it just wasn't really grabbing me because of that, there's also just an unfortunate sort of coincidence, sort of starting off with these sort of 1984-esque images of everybody in the coveralls and being forced into new think and new speak. I happen to have actually seen two adaptations of 1984 in recent months. There was a screening of the film made in 1984, the John Hurt and Richard Burton film, which was a film I was realizing as I was watching it, I'd never actually seen it, and it's a really good adaptation. And then there was also an adaptation about to open on Broadway that I saw previews of, and was not so successful, unfortunately. But sort of having been so exposed to 1984 stuff recently, this was a sort of feeling like another pale imitation.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really go there in my head. What bothered me was that as much as it was nice to see Missy actually getting some something to do, considering how long it took for them to actually tell everybody what everybody pretty much could already guess, it was that shift from the first half of the show to the second half. It was rough. The whole thing where, you know, you've got this thing where Bill is this, like, underground freedom fighter, kind of, and then she confronts the Doctor, and the Doctor seems like he's totally on the side of the monks, and that he's been that stuff was tense, and you felt like, oh, how are they going to get out of this? And then on a dime, it turns into the, oh no, it's all a big ruse, everything's great, these guys work with me, it's all good, we're fine, and you're just sitting, and especially the whole thing with the fake regeneration, completely unnecessary. It just felt like, yeah, it felt overdone, and then the whole solution to the problem was essentially, so the world was saved because Bill focused on false memories of her mother that the Doctor gave her. I already don't particularly take to Bill very well. That really just made it feel like gratuitous, it's her best showing. This is her best episode for me, but it's still not saying a lot. I'm really having a hard time getting into her performance, I guess you could say, into the way that she is. I think I've mentioned this to Gary before and on the show, and you've probably heard it, Edmund, that they seem to give Bill the personality that they need her to have for each episode.
Yes, I can. That's about it. I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really unfortunate because I'm looking for a little bit something. Just give me enough of a characterization that I have some sense of how she's going to react to situations and can enjoy watching that unfold, not learning who she is by how she deals with the circumstance differently every week. And yeah, it seems like they tried. There's a lot of things that this character needs to deal with, especially at the end of this episode. There were still a whole hell of a lot of people that died. Mm-hmm. That didn't go away. She's kind of responsible for that. So, are they going to address it? Because they should, and they don't. And it didn't escape my notice that Toby Whithouse was the one who wrote the episode, and he always seems to just be missing something for me when it comes to writing Doctor Who. So, but that was kind of my issue with that, with Doctor Who right now, is that Bill as a companion just doesn't seem to be very distinctly drawn. And so it depends a lot on the individual plots of each episode and the fact that I like Capaldi. And so the fact, you know, Gary has struggled this season largely because he's not a big fan of Capaldi. So there's not a lot for, you know, not to speak for you, Gary, but you've said it a few times this season. There's just not a whole lot for you to grab onto right now.
Nope.
Yeah. So, okay, we're going to go ahead and wrap this episode up here. And when we come back next time, we're going to get into the more recent week of episodic discussion. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth. on Twitter at Critical Myth or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.